Aloha.
Hello and welcome. We are back from the BallerLifestyle.com. It's the Baller Lifestyle Podcast. My name is Brian Beckner, episode 395. Of the show. We're talking about a classic movie today, Scarface, 1983. Immigrant refugee makes good, lives the American dream. It's a beautiful story with a happy ending. If you can't tell, I have a head cold, so bear with me. People are like, "Oh, Brian, you sound just as nasal as always." Well, no, I don't. I sound worse. But I thought head colds were canceled. I thought just a regular ass cold, you couldn't get anymore, but apparently you can. And I have one, and it's like I feel fine, but I'm just still having to blow my nose 300 times a day. So sorry to tell you guys that. Shout out to any new listeners that we may have hearing us for the first time via our promotion on the Overcast app. We appreciate any new ears that we can bring into our world. Hope you'd like the show. Additionally, if you are not already, I, as I do every week, recommend that you subscribe to our bonus content. That's where you get everything we do. You get the full show uninterrupted by commercials. You get it the night before everyone else. It's just more. You just get it all. You know, if you're not in a position to subscribe, that's okay too, because you're getting a lot. You're getting a lot. But if you're subscribing to the full show, all the bonus content, you're getting like twice as much. So there's a link that you can click in the show notes of whatever app you're listening to the show on. You can also go to theballerlifestyle.com, click the link at the top of the page. You can go to my Twitter, at Brian Beckner. Click the link there on my pinned tweet, and you can subscribe via that. If you have thoughts on the movie we discussed today, please reach out. mailbag@theballerlifestyle.com is the email address. Additionally, you can send us or call and leave a voicemail, 949-464-TBLS-8257. I am interested to hear people's thoughts on the movie we discussed today. I'm joined now, as always, by Ed Daly. Ed, what's up?
Not a whole lot. I'm excited. I'm excited for us to bring on the guest. I think he...
Of course.
He's the main attraction.
If you're a regular listener, you'll know our friend Caleb.
How's it going, guys?
Hey, what's up, Caleb?
Hey, Caleb.
I believe you last joined us for ID4.
Yeah,
maybe the worst movie we've done on this show because it was the longest.
No, we did Howard the Duck. Nothing.
That's true. Well, you know, I have the space of time.
Ernest Scared Stupid as well. I don't know that it gets any worse than that.
Well, that's weird because it was around. That's a Halloween movie.
Mm-hmm. About a year ago.
Yeah, so we did that a year ago, and look, that was horrible. But it was like low rent horrible. Like ID4 was Big Budge, and it was just dreadful. So,
when I was listening to that episode. After when it was released, I had intended to go into that episode and make more of a stalwart defense of the movie.
Yeah.
I failed completely just because I got caught up in honking off about how corny some of it was, but I don't think that's the worst one we've done. I think Ernest is so wait, is this appearance 6 for me now?
Is
what
it?
Have we done?
Wow.
We did.
Well, we Commando, did Cocktail with you.
Cocktail.
We did Cocktail with you too.
Commando Cocktail.
Fast and Furious 5.
Oh, Fast 5. You really educated us. You went down you watched every Fast and the Furious just so you could have.
That was the most research.
Oh, dude. Can I tell you guys? Can I confess?
That's the most research any guest has ever done.
Yes.
So, like, I went into that, like, you know, I hadn't really seen any of those movies since I was a kid or whatever, right? It's like, you know, fuck those stupid movies. And I went and I watched that for the research purposes. And I ended up loving all of it. I love that franchise now. I'm such a huge fan. It's so stupid. The dumbest movies ever made, and I'm here for it.
They're pretty great. But without you, we would not have known and this is a big deal for Fast and Furious people, that the movies do not exist in chronological order.
No, they do not.
They jump around, which is confusing, very confusing.
That's as close to high art as most Fast and Furious fans are ever really going to get, I think. Like non-linear storytelling.
Yeah.
I think I saw, yeah, it's like the Pulp Fiction with cars. I think I saw a story this weekend that Vin Diesel walked Paul Walker's daughter down the aisle.
Oh, like, he maybe definitely did.
This weekend.
He did. That choked me. I'm not going to lie. That choked me up.
Yeah. Family.
You know, and when he got to family. The end, he was like, family.
Yeah.
The whole wedding was just a giant cookout.
Beautiful. Yes. It was, you know, there was, you know, many a Corona was poured.
Yeah.
That's how sure.
Rodriguez was not taking shit from anybody at that wedding.
It did. And it wasn't in Brazil where they're known to go, where they went in Fast Five, but it was like in the DR or like some, like the Bahamas or something. It was somewhere.
It seems like that wedding could have taken place like between shoots. You know what I mean? Oh, who knows what they're up to?
Well, they might incorporate it in to the story. Before we get started here, and Caleb, my apologies that you don't have one of your own, and I don't know if Ed does either, but last week I was remiss in doing our salted nut roll flavor tastings. I didn't have one handy, and I have one here with me now, and I'm a little worried because
this is really important journalism that you guys are doing here. I'm excited to be part of
our space now. Caleb,
I forgot to get one.
Yeah, you're in. Well, I'm gonna take one for the whole team here. Caleb, you're in the Pacific Northwest. I assume, like me on the West Coast, you're not familiar with the Pearson salted nut roll, correct?
No, that's not a treat that we had. Not even considering the supply chain issues. God.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, these days, definitely not. Well,
you can't even get salted nuts anymore. What's going on in Biden's America?
It's crazy. It's crazy. Watch who you vote for. Last one I tasted on the show was the spicy salted nut roll, which is it's the cream of the crop as far as I'm concerned.
What kind of spice was that? Is that tell me what sort of spice we're working with?
Well, kind of like a tahine, like a chile, mm-hmm. you know, like it. Kind of a limey, like
spicy peanuts, right?
Yeah, it was like rolled in those. It was like rolled in those spicy peanuts you get at the gas station. That's exactly right.
A little hint of citrus, perhaps.
Exactly. This one here, I'm a little concerned about because this is apple pie flavor. Have you tasted this one yet, Ed?
No, the only ones I've done. Obviously, I've done the original, and then I've done pumpkin, and last week was churro.
Yeah, you were into the churro. Okay,
I wasn't digging it.
No. So I'm going to take a bite of this. I forgot to do it for my Insta story, but here we go. Nope. Fuck. Oh my God. No. Disgusting. Talk amongst yourselves.
No. Oh
my God. See, it's like just
apple pie and nuts would sound good.
To me, well, I'm assuming I'm looking forward to that one.
This is an East Coast thing. This is an East Coast treat that
No. So last Halloween, we were talking about the best Halloween candy, and then a Minnesota listener, our friend Lee was like, Lee. "You guys are forgetting the best one of all." And he sent us
this
each
is a Midwestern
bags.
Thing. This yeah. is Pearson?
And it's a Midwest thing. Pearson's salted nut rolls. So they're available on Amazon.
I've spent
but they're not
quite
available
a bit of time
in
the Midwest.
Here.
So let me see if I recognize this.
Yeah, look at it. You might recognize the packaging. I'll just proffer my review, and sorry for my lack of professionalism, but I didn't have a receptacle here at my desk so that I could regurge that bite of the apple pie flavored salted nut roll. Do not recommend. 0 stars. Quite possibly amongst the worst things I've ever put in my mouth.
What's crazy about this is it, maybe I just have Dune brain right now because it just came out, but, I'm looking at the packaging and that nut roll looks like one of the sandworms from Dune. And I'm not about that at all.
It does. I kind of see that.
My best description I give to people is it's like a much better version of Payday. It's very peanutty.
Yeah.
Yep.
But it's good. It's really good.
It's that vanilla nougat.
Yeah.
This is definitely something that I can see to any of your, I don't know what your listener breakdown is, if you have many Midwestern listeners, but
we do.
This seems like something that you would get at a come and go when you're drunk. And
I'm
there for it.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And again, we love the Pearson salted nut roll, but it's the
the flavored ones.
It's the edgy flavors that are concerning.
So far, only the spicy one has gotten a thumbs up.
Yes. Yeah.
You really got to admire them for trying. It's like Brian Wilson doing strange Beach Boys albums in like the late 60s and 70s. Yep. A lot of them flopped.
That's right.
But, you know, he was trying stuff. Talking
about Smile. Absolutely. Oh, yeah. There's actually exciting news. There's a Brian Wilson documentary coming out next month that I'm excited
to see. Yeah, I've been hearing about that. I don't know if you guys know this. I'm a huge Brian Wilson fan. I actually, when he released that Lucky Old Son album, was this back in, 2009 or 10 or something?
Yep.
I drove from, you know, I'm in the Seattle area, for those who don't know, and drove down to the Hollywood Bowl with my girlfriend at the time, and we saw all three nights of his show at the Hollywood Bowl.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's a good time.
I
have an arrest warrant out in Ventura County because of that trip. Still, to this day, as I understand.
Because you got a ticket that you didn't pay?
Yeah, I have told that story. Fuck.
No, sorry. I just guessed.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. It was, I was actually told to park. I was on the beach. We were camping, and our ranger, whatever you call him down there.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, there was some sort of brush fire. Move your car. And we left it there overnight, and I got a ticket. So I called to like contest it or whatever, and they denied it. And then I was like, well, you know, I live in Washington. I'm not going to make a court appearance. So what's going to happen to me? She's like, well, we'll issue a bench warrant in Ventura County. And I'm like, all right, well, fuck you. I'm never coming back to, I'll drive around next time.
Drive around Ventura County next time you come to Southern California.
Be careful. I'm actually an outlaw now, which is pretty badass.
It's pretty badass.
Very. I'm not. I can't claim that myself. Okay, let's get into this. We're talking Scarface, 1983. Well, hold on. Let's start with the trailer. There's a special trailer, too. Let's play that.
I've never seen the trailer. I'm really excited for this.
Great, listen.
Say hello to my new friend!
Fuck is wrong with this guy? Am I kidding me or what? Fucking peasant.
Who I when and how I fuck is none of your business, okay?
Now you're talking to me, baby. That I like.
Fuck it, fuck.
Here, fucking.
So great.
Fuck.
I mean, guys, it goes on for another minute and a half, but I got to get the total fucks out of this.
Fuck it, he's fucking.
I skipped ahead.
Give me a fucking army, you're gonna take me 197 fucks in the three-hour movie Scarface.
That's got to be one of the top ones, right?
I thought so. Hang on, 197. I thought that the 182 in Blink 182 was that there were 182 fucks in Scarface.
Maybe this is because this
director's cut.
Yeah, this came out with the DVD release.
Okay.
So
I like to imagine that Blink 182 were just wrong.
Oh, well, yeah, because like it's just one of those, it's one of those things that's
funny
that
if they're off by seven.
Well, there was no internet back then. So, this is the early days of the internet. So they probably couldn't get confirmation. It was just, this is like, the Richard Gere gerbil story or Rod Stewart getting his stomach pumped. This is urban myth sure. of the time. Right. 182.
They didn't have paunchy guys like me on the internet to be like, actually it's 197.
You're like the cop. I didn't mute myself. Yes, Ed.
Nothing. I got nothing.
Okay, so this movie came out in 1983. It's of course directed by Brian De Palma. It was written by Oliver Stone. We may have to reassess his legacy after this script.
Be careful. I saw that a lot of your guys' fans on Twitter were huge Scarface stands. Well, so
Hold on, because you might be talking to one right now. The this is a remake. As many, not many know, they were they didn't want to make another Italian mob movie, so they made a Cuban mob movie starring exclusively Italian actors doing terrible Cuban accents, which I thought was amazing. This came out in 1983. This was a big deal. They almost rated it X, right? It almost was couldn't be
fought with the censors. Yeah,
right. It almost couldn't be shown in theaters because of a execution scene, a drug deal gone bad, which I'll need explained to me when we get to that. Just let's make a note of that, because I'm not exactly sure what happened, because they were there to buy drugs and one party had money and the other party had drugs, and yet they started shooting each other for some reason. Hold on, just hold that thought. Explain it to me later. So this movie was controversial at the time. Any guesses on what the box office and or budget was, guys? Caleb, you already know, I'm sure.
Ed? No, actually, this time I don't. Yeah. What I will say is that I recall reading that it did fairly well, but not great.
Yep. Ed, your thoughts?
See, I have no idea back then. Like the numbers everything is just tough to know.
This is pre-Biden inflation.
Yeah.
I thought it did poorly. I'll say it made $25 million or something.
So the budget was somewhere, and again, these are estimates, somewhere between $23 and $37 million. And the box office, I assume this is domestic from back in the day, 1983, a very respectable, if not hearty, $66 million gross. Oh,
wow. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, especially because, you know, this couldn't have been played. You know, back then, they wouldn't play movies like this before 10 o'clock. They wouldn't play it on that many screens. You couldn't have it in a theater that was also showing Song of the South, because then the kids couldn't come from one theater. You know, they didn't want kids coming from one theater to the other. So a respectable $66 million in 1983. Does anybody need the plot explained? Is there a plot?
There's definitely a plot.
Okay, why don't you explain it for us, Caleb?
How much time you got? Because this movie is like seven fucking hours. Yeah,
it's long.
I don't know. Do we need to go over the plot? I don't know.
No, he's a Cuban refugee, right? Tony Montana. He comes. Yeah. He's comes as part of the Mariel Boatlift in 1980. He's along with many others. He emigrates. He's in a refugee camp, and then he gets a contract killing. You know, they allude to his hard scrabble time in Cuba. He's got a tattoo on his hand that shows some sort of gang affiliation. We understand he's done time. He was in the Cuban army for a while, whatever. You know, he seems like not the best dude.
The title cards right away, it's kind of like sets the tone, like this is like Dunkirk, but instead of bringing over help for the British soldiers, Cuba was bringing over all their criminals to South Florida, is how they portrayed it.
Right. So he immediately, but he's, you know, this is a Horatio Alger story. Am I using that term correctly? I mean, this is a guy that fucking wants to make a life for himself. And you know what? He fucking does that. He comes to a new country. He speaks perfect English for reasons that are unclear. He claims he watched James Cagney movies a lot growing up.
As one does
on the Cuban island. But this guy comes over, he's washing dishes, and he's like, I didn't come over here to break my fucking back. I came over here to do fucking murders and get rich. And guess what? That's exactly what he fucking does.
And fall in love with Goodyear. The Goodyear blimp.
Yes, yes. Pan Am.
Sorry, I'm going to do my... Pan Am. Actually.
Yes.
That was it. You'll notice that Pan Am, actually, I tried to find this information out, but I couldn't. Yeah. Pan Am was actually featured in this movie quite a bit. If you'll notice after he, we're jumping ahead, but after he fails to do the assassination, there's the helicopters there. Pan Am actually is in this movie quite a bit.
It was stranger to me than FedEx prominently allowing their brand to be featured in a movie where one of their fucking planes crashes into the ocean.
Interesting.
It's crazy. Like, how do you associate yourself with that? But yes, Pan Am, and a prominent airline of the time, a now defunct airline, is
this movie sunk them. Is what happened.
I guess so. That people didn't want to get on one of those Pan Am jets anymore. He comes over here. Look, I know leading up to this, to this review, we talked about it on this show quite a few times that. Growing up, you think this movie's really cool. You know, he's a badass fucking cocaine bro. There's a lot of Uzis. Uzis were popular in the 80s. You never see an Uzi anymore. Mm-hmm. It was all about Uzis back then. There's Uzis. And then you get a little bit older and you're like, fuck, these guys are doing bad accents. This movie's bullshit. And look, that's what I was saying leading up to this movie. But I watched this movie last night. Well, I watched it over the course. It's pretty long. I watched it over the course of the last two nights. And I'm here to say I was dead fucking wrong. I was dead fucking wrong. This movie is amazing. This movie is so fucking good. I wish I could watch it again right this fucking minute. And I might. I might just abandon this show and fucking turn it on again. Thankfully, my girlfriend has a Showtime subscription. I'm going to throw it on and I'm going to fucking watch another round of Scarface because this movie is fucking beautiful. I loved it.
This movie is responsible for like 40% of the mall kiosk business between the years 1990 and 05.
Everybody.
I can't tell, bro. Are you doing a bit right now or am I going to have to wait and see?
Well, everybody, it's the kind of movie that's...
I think the answer is a little bit of both.
It's a little bit of both. It's the kind of movie where I'm sitting there watching it and I'm going, this is horrible, but I'm enjoying it. It's for sure.
Okay, I'm with you. Yes.
It's so bad, but it's also fucking... You just can't try to tell yourself that they thought they were making a good movie. You just have to assume that they knew this movie is as shitty as you think it is, and then immediately you love it because you're not invested in it at all, as I wasn't. But yeah, Ed, everybody in college, high school or college or early 20s, everybody loved had that buddy that had the poster.
I have a friend that I went to high school with who actually has a tattoo of "The World Is Yours."
Shut up. And also, let's just hit that right now because he sees an ad on the Goodyear blimp. It's lit up much like Ice Cube told us about, and it says it's an ad for Pan Am, and it says "The world is yours," which, like, grammatically, does that even make sense? Shouldn't, because then he adopts that slogan as his own, and he gets a neon on his drug dealer mansion that says "The world is yours." Shouldn't it be "The world is mine"? Well, like the world is ours. Right. Like, well, he's not
for good
he's
year.
Not sharing for, it. No way.
I mean, for Pan Am, yes, the world is yours. Yes. That makes sense.
Yes.
But for him, he's still like offering it out to other people.
Yeah, he's not a philanthropist. This guy's a fucking cocaine importer. The world is yours.
How about
you give us some of your fucking all that money you're putting through the counting machines?
So what you're saying is that on the blimp it should have said "the world is yours," but in his house it should have said "the world is mine."
Yeah, like
would have been character development, Brian De Palma, you fucking hack.
Oh yes, there's a lot of hacky things going on. First, so one thing I liked, they're in the refugee camp, right? And Al Pacino, do we have any? How old is Al Pacino? Like, how old are we to believe the character is in this movie?
Should we do the guest thing? We did it on Independence Day, didn't we?
Well, yeah. Okay, let's hold on. We got a few of these to do, by the way.
Okay.
What's his age? I can't explain. He was young.
But when he did that thing, still alive, and I don't know why. How old is this fucking guy?
So this movie's supposed to take place in 1980, right?
Was it 80 on the dot? Early 80s.
Yeah, because the boat lift was in the 80. And then he's in...
It was, you know, 80.
Yeah, 80, 81, comes out in 83. How old, Ed, I'll let you go first. How old do you think Al Pacino was when they shot this movie?
I mean, I think he was supposed to be like 20, I would say like 26 or something in the movie.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
He looked like he was a 45. He looks like he's my age.
Yeah.
You know,
the wig didn't help. Yeah. They put him in a wig the whole time, which just doesn't help. He looks weathered. The man smokes a lot of cigarettes. Caleb, your thoughts. How old did you think he looked in this movie?
Did he look, or how old was he supposed to be?
Either. Both.
I'm going to agree with Ed. 26 sounds about the right time for you to be an ex-army guy that goes to jail.
Yep.
I mean, there's no way that he was any younger than 40. There's just no way. Okay. I'm going to guess. So I look like shit, but I'm 35. So I'm going to guess he was 39.
You're pretty close. And remember, his sister Gina,
mm-hmm,
is 19. She does. But I'm saying, how big of a gap between children do we think that Mrs. Montana had? So at the most, he's supposed to be 26 or 27,
mm-hmm,
in this movie. If he's got a 19-year-old sister. He's born April 25th, 1940. So he was about, he was 40 years old in 1980, or, you know, he was in his early 40s when they shot this.
Yeah.
Which, and he definitely looked it. The one thing I noticed, a couple things. First of all, Oliver Stone, hack. We got to go back through this guy's catalog. And, you know, I was never a huge fan.
You didn't like Alexander?
No. I was never a huge fan. But I've always thought Platoon was good. And now I got to go back and rewatch Platoon to see if Oliver Stone has ever written anything good. Because
he's written all kinds of good stuff. He just has also done a lot of really bad stuff too.
Right.
Well, because his editing too, a lot of his movies get fucked up with the editing on top of it. So even if he writes a good scene, it's disconcerting. I liked parts of Wall Street, but if you critically analyze what happens, you're like, this doesn't make any sense. This isn't how the world works.
I'm just speaking specifically. I mean, the story is ridiculous in this movie. It's on its face. The characters are just flat, empty vessels. There's not really any depth to anybody, but I'm just talking about the dialogue. So they're in the refugee camp. Where, again, this is why you need men on a movie set, because they're playing a basketball game. And as near as I can tell, it's 1-on-60. There's so many guys on the court. You couldn't drive to the lane because there's a literal mob in front of you. And they all seem to be defending Al Pacino, who shoots a sad jumper that goes off the rim. But I'll let that go. Manolo, who's the real star of the movie, I think. Manolo comes over and he's like, hey man, he's like, I think I got something for us. I got a way for us to get green cards, basically. And he goes through it. He's like, basically, I know a guy with money, a Cuban expat that's here. He says, if we fucking kill this guy that's coming into the camp that tortured his family, that he'll give us green cards and we'll get jobs or whatever. We'll get out of here. Oh, and money. And Al Pacino in character, his response is, I kill communists for fun, but for a green card, I carve them up real nice.
Yeah. What is that line?
We're supposed to let a guy have a career in Hollywood that writes like that? We're supposed to regard him as an auteur? I don't think so.
And Pacino isn't far removed from just some spectacular acting performances. But this one,
yes,
he's way overacting. Like, yes. I mean, he was very subtle in a lot of those 70s hits.
Yes.
Like Sidney Lumet movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
How much, because you're right, Ed, you're right on the money there, but how much do you attribute that to Oliver and how much do you attribute that to Brian De Palma? Just broadly asked.
The performance, you mean.
So what's in De Palma's catalog before this?
Oh my, the one that I watched for studying, I watched his documentary, De Palma, that he goes through.
I've seen that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I also, but the only other one that I watched specifically for research was I watched Untouchables. And yes. If you want to talk about corny ass, shitty gangster movies, it does not get any worse than
this.
Untouchables.
They send one of ours to the hospital. We send two of theirs to the morgue. That's a particularly bad
movie.
De Niro performance. Okay, let's see what else this guy's done. Brian De Palma, because he's considered a legend too.
Well, De Palma's done a lot of good stuff too.
Oh yeah, Body Double.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good movie. Oh, he does the Frankie Goes to Hollywood Relax video. I've never. Changed my fucking tune on this. The Untouchables, Bruce Springsteen movies. Oh, he does Casualties of War with
Michael J. Fox and Sean.
That was a good one.
Yep.
Yeah, it was a good movie.
He did Carlito's Way too, didn't he? That was a good one.
Bonfire of the Vanities.
Bonfire was one of the all-time bombs. That was like a huge, massive book.
Yes.
Great book. And it fell flat.
Well, he definitely, he did Carrie. That's the only other one that I know, really. I'm not like a huge De Palma guy.
Oh my God. He did the, maybe an underrated, but possibly one of Nicolas Cage's greatest performances, Snake Eyes.
Oh man.
I did not know that. That's great.
Yes. With the incomparable Carla Gugino.
And Gary Sinise parlaying his Lieutenant Dan fame to play.
That's right. To play the heavy
amount.
Mission to Mars. Too. So he did some shit.
He did a lot of garbage. A lot of good stuff, but a lot of garbage.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, no, he sucks. I mean, he's the stench of this movie is on him. But you look back, Pacino, a lot of wigs. I'm just looking at pictures. He's got some stink. He is great, but he took a long spell where he was just fucking phoning it in, where he was just so over the top in everything he did.
But was this the first time where he went over the top, Al? Because he's subtle in some of those 70s movies. I mean, even in Dog Day Afternoon, he's big, but he plays certain scenes,
You're out of order. You're out of order. This whole place is out of order.
Yeah, he was good in the 70s, and then this thing was oh my God. And he's doing the worst impression of a Latin American man.
God. So
just
he was really stoked to do this movie, by the way. I don't know. Legend has it he was the one that there's conflicting accounts depending on who you ask, but as the legend goes, he was the one that he watched Scarface and was like, I want to do that, but different. And that's when he actually initially Marty Bergman reached out to Oliver Stone to write the script. So as history, I think, has accepted by this point, this whole thing was Pacino's kind of baby. So maybe he was just really stoked to be doing this. I don't know.
Maybe he was getting high on his own supply. He did Scarface, followed by something called Revolution that I'm not familiar with. Then Sea of Love, which was very... I haven't
seen either of those, honestly.
Oh, Sea of Love was...
A lot of Ellen Barkin.
Right? Ellen Barkin. He was railing Ellen Barkin the whole time. And it was... That was a big touchstone for a junior high age Brian Beckner's... To my adolescence was marked. There's pre Sea of Love, and there's post Sea of Love.
To me, it was Brian Angel Becker. Heart. Angel
also. Was the
that was oh, the that blueprint.
Was fan- that was fantastic too. But right after that, he did Dick Tracy, which is amongst the worst films ever made, followed by The Godfather Part 3, which also sucked. There's Glengarry Glen Ross, which is amazing. He's great in Carlito's Way, which is kind of hot and cold. Heat, which was great. Yeah. Donnie Brasco. He's very good in Donnie Brasco. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
But right after that is when he played the devil in The Devil's Advocate. Oh. The Insider, that's that Russell Crowe 60 Minutes one, right? That won a bunch of Academy Awards.
I wasn't sure. You're definitely reading his like IMDb page right now, aren't you?
Yeah, I am.
Okay, okay.
You think I had this on the top of my head?
I was like, damn, he's just
a super fan.
Then he's in Any Given Sunday, which Ed and I have differing opinions on.
Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah, it's horrible. Then Insomnia, which is a good movie. Then he goes a ways without being in it. Geely. He's in Geely. Ocean's 13. I don't know. He's hot and cold. He's very good in The Irishman, I would say. So he's kind of come back.
Speaking of movies that take like 30 sittings to get through the whole thing.
Oh, my fucking God. Yeah. I don't know if now's the time to talk about The Irishman, but... If you want a movie with 6 hours of old men geriatrics stealing meat to saxophone music, that's for you.
It took me a week of like putting it on each day for a week to get through it.
I'm still watching it.
I like how they're like they use this new technology to give them digital facelifts and stretch out their faces to look young again. And you're like, yeah, I mean, they look like kind of weird old men, but they move like they're 95 years old. Like
the beat-up scene. Oh my God.
Yes. Robert De Niro's kicking the shit out of somebody outside of a fucking grocery store. And I'm like, this guy can't move. Like, get a young guy to do the actual stunts and paste Robert De Niro's young face on him
Exactly. That really looked like when you're like 9 and you're pretending to do pro wrestling with your friends. And you're like, that's what that looked like. It was so bad.
Yes. So we talked about this before and I just have a note here. Do these guys seem remotely Cuban? And I know that there's a thing now. I saw a couple weeks ago that Sarah Silverman would like, she got ratioed for, because she was talking about Jew face, people who aren't Jews playing Jewish characters, which I think is fine. I'm not saying you had to fucking hire Cuban actors to play these Cuban characters, but they're not one of them, even Stephen Bauer, who apparently is Cuban.
He's the only one, isn't he?
Yes, he's the only one. The rest of them were so bad, the accents. And it was either Al Pacino, who's got the accent turned up to 11 the whole time, or Robert Loggia, who you're like, wait, he's talking Cuban now, and now he's talking like he's from New York, and now it's like...
All over the place.
Yeah. F. Murray Abraham, like all of them, it's just like...
Sarah Silverman's thing is a little different, because as a Jew, what I would say is... How are you going to have a hard time finding Jews to play actors in Hollywood? Sure. That's just ridiculous.
No, absolutely. Like, but there probably were some Cuban people that they could have mix it. I get that Al Pacino's a movie star, and I guess they think they did. I guess they did hire a Cuban American and Stephen Bauer, but like the rest of them are just like it was bad. Yeah,
I don't really have a problem necessarily with casting, you know, somebody of a different ethnicity or background. I don't really have a problem with that, because I mean, it's fucking acting, right? Yes. But what I would say is, like, you know, you just kind of, I think, legitimately do open up yourself up to more criticism. Like, if you fuck the movie up, or if you don't portray those people, that group of people correctly,
totally,
then yeah, for sure.
Then you open yourself up to criticism. I did see somewhere in the trivia, I think, that Michelle Pfeiffer, you know, it's like
also Cuban.
Yes. I think she had done, I think she must've done Grease 2 at this point. But she hadn't really been in anything. And then they give a list of, well, I can't find it now, but they give a list of who they might have hired. And it was like all the big hitters of the day. And it was like Glenn Close, Sigourney Weaver, like every, like, all the fuck. Oh, it's right here. Glenn Close was the original choice for the role, while others were also considered, including Gina Davis, Carrie Fisher, Kelly McGillis, Rosanna Arquette, Melanie Griffith, Kim Basinger, Sharon Stone, and Sigourney Weaver. Any one of which would have been a better choice.
Yeah.
Carrie Fisher would be maybe just too associated with a different role.
Yeah.
The rest of them, you didn't know.
Bad girl thing, though.
Yeah.
But you didn't know who Gina Davis or Sharon Stone at that point. That, you know, sure. You wouldn't have had. But yeah.
It was just too big a role. You know, she's in a lot of the movie. The character is such a fucking wet blanket.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of I've been obviously doing my homework and reading about this. There's a lot of like video essays and stuff that I've been reading about, like how people really misunderstand her character and or at least how Al Pacino does or Tony Montana, in that, like, even in the scene where he's like, hey, I'm going to murder your husband and then, like, make you have my kids or whatever. And, like, he thinks that he's just the shit. But, like, she gets up and then, like, puts on more clothes to, like, you know, symbolize, I don't really want anything to do with you, but I'm just, like, kind of helpless, hapless.
Well, it is kind of a weird, and this is, I'm going to blame this on Oliver Stone. She is... for all intents and purposes repulsed by him. She can't stand him. She tells him as much. She's like, I'm not getting into your shitty fucking car. He takes her to a Porsche dealership to try to impress her. By the way, look, she did get in the car. How'd she get to the Porsche dealership? He tries to make out with her. She's disgusted by him. And then one day, and we should talk about the security at Robert Loge. What's Robert Loge's character's name? Frank's a high level fucking drug dealer in Miami. You might want to, like, I don't know, get like a couple Dobermans or maybe like a gate that locks or something. But he's not home one day, and then Tony shows up and
he's like, I'm in your base.
He cruises in the backyard where she's, you know, all she does is sun herself and do cocaine. And she's sitting out there reading a magazine. She's reading Us Weekly. And he cruises up and he's like, I want to tell you something. He's like, I want you to have my children. And it's like, they haven't flirted. They haven't held hands. They haven't fucking smiled at each other.
Yeah. She shows no interest to that point.
No, she's disgusted by him the entire time. And then he goes, and then his come on to her is, hey, I would like to breed you. I would like you to incubate my lineage. And she's like,
hell yeah.
Yeah. She's like, all of a sudden she's thinking about it.
So that's just, you guys are a little older than I am. No. That's just how the 80s were, maybe. Yeah.
Like, no. Definitely not. Not as far as I remember.
Like, what's the...
That's not how it worked for me.
The chainsaw scene where, like, what's his name? Stephen Bauer.
Manolo.
Manolo, excuse me. He's out there just, like, whistling and, like, doing, like, grabby fingers at women, and it works.
Yes.
A little. It works a little. Enough to me for me to be like, that's interesting.
Well... He's a one in a thousand guy. We've all known this guy.
He's hot.
Yeah. Well, he is gorgeous, but he's
beautiful.
He does a thing that everyone's gotten, has a guy in their group that does this.
I mean, not that was rapey.
Well, yeah, I'm not saying everyone knows somebody that does a cunnilingus. Come on. What I'm saying is everyone knows a guy that hits on literally every woman he sees. And eventually
it works.
It works. Like it's a numbers game.
It is. Like some poor woman is having a bad day and she just kind of gets caught up and ensnared in this guy's trap. Yeah. 100%.
Yes. Eventually it works. And
I'd say about him though is what we established. He is the one Cuban member of the cast. And he plays the worst Latin stereotype.
Yes.
He plays plays the rapey, horny Ricky Ricardo kind of just over the top ridiculous. There were a lot of over the top performances. F. Murray Abraham as the coke dealer, all these different guys. But it was Stephen Bauer who really did the biggest disservice to Cubans everywhere.
He did. And you know what? I did that thing that I always do, Ed, where I'm like, man, this poor guy, he fucking never worked again. And you never saw him in anything again.
Oh, he was in Traffic. That was a great movie.
That's what I thought. Yeah, he was fucking good in Traffic.
The guy's had at least 3 jobs every year since.
Yeah.
He's on Breaking Bad. He's on like every procedural show. He's on Better Call Saul. He's done everything. Let's take it back. Let's see. I actually have a clip here of Manolo. And I mean, just some brilliant dialogue by the great Oliver Stone here, where these guys are discussing their come up in Miami.
This is paradise, I'm telling you. This sounds like a great big pussy just waiting to get fucked.
Just in case you didn't hear that, he said,
yeah,
this town is like a great big pussy waiting to get fucked. That is, I mean, just brilliant dialogue.
I'm telling you, I tried to come here 10 years ago. I'd have been a millionaire by this point. By this time, I'd have my own boat, my own car, my own golf course.
You know what I want? Thought of this the other day. A line of blue jeans, right? With my name written on the back of chicks' asses. How about?
That sounds completely crazy to me.
Look at that. Look, you're missing all the sights. That's what you're doing.
He can't stop looking at the broads.
Oh, yeah. Sabrosura. You want to have some ice cream with my friend of me?
Get lost, please.
Yeah, loser. Yeah.
Look at that.
Ice cream?
All right.
You said ice cream?
Girl like ice cream.
Oh, come on, man. That's not going to work. Mm-hmm. You can't do it that way. I'm telling you. You know how you pick up chicks in this country?
This is how you do it. Take notes.
Beautiful. What the fuck was that?
Yeah.
What you just did.
That's it. That's what you do.
That's what you do.
That is disgusting.
Why?
So what we're seeing here is the difference between a man who's 5'2 and a man who's 6 foot tall.
That's true. It's true. That's a good point.
I know. He looks like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar next to Pacino.
That is kind of a problem. Then you guys get the picture. Then he puts him up to going up and trying his tongue move to some chick at the pool who slaps him in the face.
But the one thing about Tony Montana, who's a maniac, and we have all these there's so many problematic aspects to him. But the fact that he wouldn't want his little sister, to be with Stephen Bauer, it makes a lot of sense.
He's taller than him.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, there is something going on there. Like, I mean, we don't know that he doesn't want them to be together, because despite the fact that they know he's a psychopath, and they know he might have an issue with it, they don't like. You ever like have to break some bad news to somebody?
And hey, you, I'm banging your sister. Sorry,
right. But you give them a little bit at a time, so it's not such a big surprise. You start, you know, a few weeks out, where you just say, "Hey, what would you think about, you know, maybe Gina dated somebody you trusted, somebody that you knew would treat her well? Like, how would you feel about that?" And you kind of warm him up to the idea. Manolo, who clearly deserved better than the fate he ended up with, he didn't play it right. And neither did Gina. You know, she just walked out there half naked on that veranda, that landing.
Well, both of them should have known better, predicated on Tony's previous reactions to them, right? You know, they should have known.
Yes.
I don't know. I guess what I would say is one interesting thing about this movie is, I'm sure you guys both know, but if the listener, if you don't, it's, you know, this is a remake off of a 1932 gangster movie.
That's right.
By Capone, right?
Kind of. So the original script was based off of a book that was loosely based on Capone. So kind of. You're seeing like 4 degrees of separation between Al Capone and Tony Montana. But yeah. the whole sister thing in the 32 film, which is fantastic, a great gangster movie if that's your shtick, and actually pretty funny in a weird way. I recommend it. Go watch it. But the sister thing was really supposed to be more of a, you know, he has the almost incestual angle to it, but it's more like, I don't want her involved in this world, because the whole sister going after his best friend thing happens, but it's not, you know, in Scarface, they made it really like rapey and incestual, like in a weird, weird way that didn't need to happen.
So what you're saying is it's bad filmmaking. Like Brian De Palma didn't tell that story well enough where he's supposed to be protecting her rather than acting like a jealous lover, because let's not to spoil it for everybody. She comes out at the end shooting a gun at him saying, do you want to fuck me? I know you want to fuck me.
Yeah.
Which you're saying is not actually his motivation in the source material.
Maybe it is. I think that, so let me say this. In the 32 version, no. In the 1980 version, yeah, maybe. I think that they were trying to explore that. They just did a poor job. You can blame Brian De Palma. You could blame Oliver Stone. I don't know. So if you don't know, there was a lot of controversy between those two men. They've since buried the hatchet. But for the listener at home, if you don't know the history of this movie, Oliver Stone wrote it, and he kind of like lurked on set and was trying to like tell the actors how to like act scenes. And Brian De Palma and Marty Bergman were like rewriting things and recutting things that Oliver Stone didn't like. And it turned into this huge argument that they eventually had to escort Oliver Stone off of the set with security.
Wow.
So, now, you know,
at that point,
two different Stone, movies being made.
Had Stone directed anything at that point?
I don't think so. He had. He was younger. Let's look at his page.
Cause here. It's a few years before Platoon. And then, he did
Salvador, but that would have been after this, right? Salvador is probably like 85.
Let's look. I'm pulling it up now.
Pull it up.
He had done a couple things. I don't think, I mean, he certainly was. He was still right at the time. He wasn't direct.
Right.
One thing he had done, cocaine. That's pretty.
That's for sure.
Yeah. He had done Midnight Express. He'd done all kinds of stuff.
I'm forgetting. Midnight Express was probably what put him on the map.
But he didn't direct that. He wrote it.
Midnight Express. Let's see.
I don't think he directed it. Until Salvador.
Yeah, you're right. He did. He just wrote it. He had directed a movie called Seizure, which I've never seen, that has a 3% on Rotten Tomatoes. So you're right.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. A couple shorts and then something called The Hand, and then Salvador, Platoon, Wall Street. He had a little run there. Salvador, Platoon, Wall Street, Talk Radio, Born on the 4th of July, The Doors, JFK.
Right. So he eventually went to do good stuff. But the point is, like, at the time, he's on the set trying to tell the actors how to do stuff. Brian De Palma's like, get this fucking guy off the set, which, you know, and I'm not, you know, taking sides here at all. I mean, Oliver Stone didn't prove himself till years later. But what you have here essentially is two very different interpretations of the movie.
Right.
And
sure.
Like, famously, Oliver Stone was pro Castro and, you know, he's openly socialist or whatever. So when people, maybe if you're if you have left politics, you may have seen a lot of people criticize this as like being kind of an anti-communist movie. That's not necessarily the case. I think that this movie is really misunderstood for that reason and a lot of others.
Yes.
But that's primarily for this reason and for many others, because all the people involved, Pacino had an idea of what this film was supposed to be. Bergman did.
He had an idea.
This is just this is too many, a classic case of too many cooks in the kitchen. This dude's not rocking. These guys are not on the same page at all.
No, I agree with that. It was nice. There are a lot of familiar faces in this movie. Of course, F. Murray Abraham is there as Omar, and he gets I know. I know where you're going with this. And he gets, you know, he gets done pretty heavy when he gets thrown out of a helicopter, which would have done the job, I would say, except that they had a noose tied around his neck, so it was kind of like,
him.
Yeah, just drop them, or you know, either way, or just hang them.
They wanted
from something.
To kill the helicopter pilot too. They just failed.
Right, exactly. But old friend, Hector Salamanca.
Yeah, they're down in Bolivia. Where is it, Bolivia, when they see him?
Yeah, they're Bolivia.
Yeah,
Hector Salamanca shows up as one of Sosa's henchmen.
Enforcers, yeah.
And
that's a guy who's never a young man.
Yeah, Hector Salamanca was just as old in 1980 as he is right now on Better Call Saul.
He did not age.
Yeah, he was 70 when he was 40.
Do you guys think Omar was an informant or not?
No.
I did when I watched it. Now thinking back, maybe it was, you know, they just wanted to have fewer degrees of separation.
Yeah.
I that's what I got out of it.
Yeah.
So he was trying to consolidate.
Yeah.
That's my thought is, like, you know, Tony obviously admires Sosa. It's kind of like who he wants to mirror himself after.
Yeah.
I thought that maybe if you want to give this movie enough credit to be this deep, maybe you don't, but at the end, when they killed Tony, they wrote Savito on the wall in his blood, which means rat informant.
Right.
Obviously, Tony was not an informant, and it makes you think, well, okay, was Omar? Is Sosa just as paranoid as Tony? Did he follow in the footsteps? This is interesting kind of thing. That, I don't know. I don't think that he was.
So I looked to see if Sosa, another beautiful man.
Yeah, just gorgeous.
Gorgeous, gorgeous man. I looked to see what other stuff he'd done. Unfortunately, he quickly succumbed to the bug not long after this movie. So R.I.P. Paul Chenard, another
very handsome
Hispanic playing a Hispanic.
Paul Chenard.
Yeah, Paul Chenard.
So this movie has the challenge of, okay, so they didn't want to do the Italian mob, and so they wanted to take it to Cubans and Colombians and the drug trade. But the problem was there were so many scenes between Spanish speakers, and they're all speaking English to each other.
Yes.
And one of the things they did was, like, they all spoke with accents except for Robert Loggia, who opted out after, like, his fourth line.
He kind of, when they have the nightclub encounter and later when he's begging for his life, he's doing the accent.
He's slipping in and out, but I found it funny that they would sometimes use Spanish phrases in the middle of an English sentence, like "mi hijo, you're taking it too far."
Yes, well, no, totally. Yeah.
What is it? What are you saying?
And then when they go to do the hit at the UN, Hector Salamanca is speaking almost exclusively in Spanish when they're in the car, and Al Pacino has to respond to him also in Spanish. And you could tell they really practiced that. They used an economy of language, not have him say too many words. And he's still, his Spanish was not great in those scenes.
And by the way, I looked up F. Murray Abraham, 'cause I was thinking he's kind of one of those famous older looking dudes. Like, was he ever a young man actor?
Never.
Anything. And I didn't see it, but I did see he was the Grapes and Fruit of the Looms commercials in the 70s.
Shut the fuck up.
We all have to start somewhere.
Wow, got to start somewhere. F. Murray Abraham, Academy Award winner, F. Murray Abraham.
He's a great actor.
He's great, and he's good in this movie. Okay, what else? So,
you want to talk bubble bath? Bubble baths?
Oh, amazing. Yeah.
It's pretty amazing for a grown man to be just taking lots of bubble baths.
Well, and that tub, I'm thinking to myself, it must take half the day. He must need a fire hose brought in to fill up the tub, because the tub is the size of a medium sized pool.
Why does he have carpet all around that goddamn bathtub? It was driving me crazy.
I know.
Just disgusting.
And yes,
it's like Graceland. A lot of wall to wall carpeting.
He basically decorates in a child's idea of what a rich person's mansion would look like. I mean, he has a tiger.
Yeah. Okay.
He has lots of gold things. Like, it's pretty bitchin'. Lots of red.
This is like the beginning of Rocky II, where like an uneducated guy doesn't know what to do with all his newfound riches.
Well, that's interesting that you guys mentioned that in the scene that he's with Sosa the first time. It's Sosa, him, and Omar. Neither of them are eating the garnish, but he's eating his garment. Like, it shows that he's just a classless piece of shit.
Like, yeah, they brought out like the finger water that you're supposed to like clean your hands between courses.
He drinks it
and he's eating the lemon water. I forgot about that.
So it kind of shows. And then of course a guy like that's absolutely going to buy a tiger. Like, so
yeah,
the one thing that I'll always remember about Scarface is I had a dude that I came up with that was like my first like stoner buddy or whatever. Because you'd have to go to people now don't understand what it was like before weed was legal.
Yeah.
Like you had a friend that essentially assumed all the risk of getting caught buying drugs. And what he got in return for that is you had to go to his house and hang out with him to smoke weed.
Yeah.
And he would always put on Scarface. And I swear to God, he would put on the tiger scene and he would either pause it or talk over and rewind the tiger scene and talk about how someday he hoped that he would also own a tiger.
Unbelievable.
This kind of sounds similar to the Alfred Molina scene in Boogie Nights. Like, he had to go and weird things were happening.
Oh yeah, totally. Yep. Good point. Also at that point, has Manolo been taking classes at the local junior college with Stringer Bell? Because where you have Tony's, you know, he's starting to get paranoid. They're letting us know that this, you know, he's caught up in the game, which is what Oliver Stone is the point that Oliver Stone is trying to make with the script, right? Where he's too caught up in being a big shot, you know, making a lot of money. And now he's got to have security cameras and he's got this whole security set up. And Manolo's like, hey man, he's like, this is already costing us 12% of our adjusted gross. And I was like, oh, this guy, wow, he's gone to school. He's taking some accounting classes to help out Tony here.
Night school business courses.
Yes, he's really paying attention. And I would have said, like, maybe invest a little bit more, because when it came time to need that security system,
I gotta say,
wasn't too effective.
His setup did not really look like 12% of his gross.
No, it didn't. You know, it was just a few cameras.
There's a couple cameras and then a couple of guys who were completely and totally useless during the final fight.
Yeah. I mean, they came up right. They did stranglings and these guys didn't even hear them coming. They had a whole army of Bolivians descend upon the Montana compound and every single one of his guys had their back turned.
Yeah. To be fair, when you're defending a house, the best way to do that is to stare at the house.
Right. That's a good point. That's good. Speaking of security, so Frank, he commissions a hit on Tony. And of course, the best way to commit a drug murder is to have two low rent cokeheads show up at a nightclub with Uzis.
Yeah, I love that. But they put napkins over them.
Have them casing the joint for like 5 minutes first.
Yeah, they're there. And then Richard Belzer, speaking of how fucking old is this guy, Richard Belzer's there. He's doing his like Borscht Belt act on stage. He looks about 61 years old in 1980. But then he goes, hey, and for our next act, all the way from Venezuela, it's Octavio. And then the lights go down and the low rent henchmen are like, have to put they have Uzis, but they're just covered up with napkins.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, we can't, it's going to be too dark to do the murder. But I want to talk about this guy, Octavio. Like, what was this guy's act? He came out, he had like a paper mache mask on.
He was like a clown.
He was kind of like a clown, but he was like dancing, not funny. And everybody in the audience was just absolutely riveted.
Well, I think this performance is another classic callback to the Hellenistic era, where rich houses would have a fool. And the fool wasn't necessarily a jester that just juggled. The fool would tell stories,
right,
and do tricks and enlighten the audience. And I think that in classic Oliver Stone fashion, he is going high art, and this is supposed to be a fool.
Right. Oh, good point. Well,
I believe they were usually eunuchs.
The fools. Oh, interesting. Good to know. Yeah. Well, the fool definitely ended up the fool, because basically these two hitmen, they blasted machine gun rounds throughout the bar, and the only one I saw that got killed was Octavio. And yeah, of course, 100%. The two bad guys. One thing also I liked is that when Tony has the meeting with the crooked cop, you always know the guy that's the cop in the club, because despite the fact that he's there asking for a bribe, for a monthly stipend to be an enforcer for Tony and keep the cops off his back, he orders a glass of milk. Because you can't drink on the job. You can't drink when you're asking for $50,000 a month in bribes and two tickets to London to take the wife for your anniversary. You can't get a gin and tonic.
No, that would be too much. That would be unethical.
Yes. You got to have a large, just a big ass full glass of milk.
I love it. Give me that moo juice.
Milk. Yeah, dude. It's got to be milk. Got to be. Can't be a water. Can't be a Coke. It's got to be milk.
Got to be milk. So, I mean, Tony kind of sets himself up there. He's not real subtle about going after Elvira Hancock, which, by the way, is like the pussy galore of drug dealer girlfriends' names. Mm-hmm. He's right up in there. He's got his fucking arm around her at the bar, and Frank shows up and he's like, why don't you get your own girl? And he's like, that's what I'm doing, ma. That's what I'm right here. So they have a tete-a-tete, and then Tony sees his girl or his sister Gina dancing with Fernando, and there's a big scene there.
A nice guy. Fernando seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. He took her in the bathroom to do some blow. That's pretty nice of him.
It is nice to give out your cocaine like that. It's hard to get.
Exactly. Yeah. He shares. So then Manolo drives her home and leaves Tony alone. Again, the security aspect is lacking here, but Tony, he's real sad. You could tell he's real sad because he's slouched way down in his seat.
He looked drunk. Yeah.
He was drunk. Yeah. He was drinking. And
last night watching this fucking movie for the fourth time.
Exactly. You're feeling the same. But yeah, he dodges the murder. It's obvious that because of their falling out earlier in the evening, Frank has sent these guys to kill him. He's become a rival. They used to work together, but no more. So then Frank and the dirty cop and Frank's like bodyguard guy head back to his place. And Tony and Manolo, they hatch a plan. Tony and Manolo and Angel are like, okay, let's go over there. For the second time in this movie, first time, at least it's outside, Tony walks directly into a drug dealer's backyard and up to his pool to his girlfriend. This time, despite the fact that they had just commissioned a fucking hit on a rival drug dealer, there's nobody watching the door. There's nobody. There's no armed surveillance. There's no cameras.
Tony. Well, no, actually, there is. It's because Ernie, the guy with him, his security, Ernie, the security guy, was there. And then not only did he fail at his job, Tony was like, hey, Ernie, you want a job for the worst security team ever assembled?
Ernie, the guy that's supposed to be watching the place, is literally the furthest one from the door. When they all walk in armed, get the drop on everybody, and everybody knows they're about to be murdered. I mean, just how has this guy made it this long in the cocaine game in Miami if this is the kind of operation he's running?
Because Frank came up at a time where cocaine dealers were simply nice.
Right.
Yes. Just like Fernando, who was giving out his cocaine, Frank also he was just a nice guy.
Just a good dude.
They had code back then.
Yeah.
Yes. Code. Yeah. Tony destroyed the code.
Yes. Yeah. I thought that that was crazy. Also, I did like a little foreshadowing when, I mean, Gina quickly gets over her embarrassment at the scene that's been made when she's in the men's room with Fernando. And then Manolo's driving her home and she's like, how come you never asked me out, Manolo? And she goes like this. I see the way you look at me. Well, he fucking looks at literally every woman that way. Like, it's, how is it any different the way he looks at you?
They're both just horny all the time. It was inevitable. It was fate they ended up hooking up.
He reaches under the skirt of literally every woman he sees.
Yes.
Oh my God.
He's basically a rapist.
He's not just looking. He's dude, grabbing.
Yeah, I forgot about that. And then oh my God.
I mean, it was a different time.
It was the 80s, dude. Yes, all you needed 80s. To be successful is you just hop in a 17-foot long car and drive around and find a life.
So now Frank's been murdered and Elvira, like, look, whether or not she fell in love with Tony, she needed a meal ticket. Like, she had a lifestyle. Frank was providing a lifestyle to her where she could hang out by the pool, get her nails done, shop, complain about going to the Babylon Club again. Well, it fucking looks like they do a pretty good spread at the Babylon Club.
Look good to me.
You know, this wasn't fucking Burger King. This wasn't, you know, working for a living. Seems like Frank took pretty good care of her. But now Frank's out of the picture. And Elvira and Tony are immediately together. I never really got that there was a love connection there. Because all they did was fight and talk shit on each other. Yeah, Do you think they could have benefited from some couples counseling?
She hated him in less than 5 minutes after he took her away from the Frank universe. Like, there were scenes showing how much she hated him less than 5 minutes later.
Were there any scenes showing that she liked him?
No problem. Well, when he woke her up to say, I just murked your boyfriend.
Let's go.
Let's go. She did willingly go. She's like, all right, cool. I got a new boyfriend.
Yeah. I mean, I guess could have been interpreted as more of a hostage situation or kidnapping.
Yeah.
No. She's feminist icon Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes.
Killing men.
Yes. Now, but then immediately Tony's really spiraling. They have that fight. They have that fight at the Babylon Club, you know, wherever they're having dinner. I think it was the Babylon Club. And he's got he doesn't like keep it private. You know, he's yelling at all the other patrons.
Singing out to the bad guy scene?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is my favorite scene. It's one of the only ones that I'll say is an unironically good scene, I think.
Well, he does. And he does like a long monologue there where, you know, it's Al Pacino, you know, he's really there
at this point. Like, the only, like, if you've gotten to this point in the movie and you're still watching, that means you've gotten over the fact that the accent is terrible and you can enjoy it for what it is. That was actually a really good scene.
Yeah. You're in.
I mean, I was in minute one.
Is this when he says, why don't you take a job with black kids or lepers?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that was it. Wasn't that when he's in the bathtub?
Yeah, that was the bathtub scene.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He should be a nurse.
Why don't you take a job with black kids or lepers?
I mean, that was actually good. There were some funny moments, especially between Manolo and Tony.
Yeah, that was when he was drinking the loudmouth soup at the restaurant and he was just blowing up.
Yeah, yeah. He lost his shit. He's yelling at everybody. Manolo's got to take Elvira home. He's spiraling. It's after that he gets popped. Manolo's like, hey, I worked out this thing with this other guy. They're having a problem laundering their money. This is before.
Again, his security is the one that got him set up with this guy who eventually nails him, by the way.
Right. This was before the Reagan administration made it easy to go down and launder your money with Manuel Noriega. That wasn't available to them yet because the CIA wasn't trading the cocaine for guns for the Contras. So they, they're having a problem laundering money. And, you know, Manolo, he's a worker. He's loyal. And he's like, look.
He's very bad at his job, but he does love Tony.
Right. He goes, look, I met this guy, Seidelman. You know, he's a moneylender. Like, I'm just saying, you could have had that character not have a Jewish name. That's all I'm saying. He's going to help us launder this money. He's like, I'm going to go meet with him. And Tony's like, no, I'm going to go meet with, you know, he sort of cucks Manolo. And Manolo even says, you know what, man, you're an asshole. And he leaves. He bounces. Oh, because he has a date to do, probably to go roofie some chicks he met at the pool. So, but then Tony goes and he gets popped. Turns out Seidelman's a cop. They're laundering money and he's looking at some time. He's going to do like 5 years. And that's when Sosa comes through with an offer. He goes down to Bolivia. He meets with Hector Salamanca and everybody. And they're like, hey, kill this guy, do this murder. And again, this is interesting. And maybe you guys can help me understand this. He's the biggest drug dealer in Miami at this point.
Yeah.
He's going to accompany.
Yeah, that was so stupid. So
the dudes that are doing the fucking hitman murder in New York, where he can easily be implicated, rather than send somebody that's he's not directly connected to do the job for him. Was that crazy to you guys?
Yeah, and Salamanca is like 75. He can do the job on his own. He doesn't need Tony there.
That's true. Good point.
100%. He would have been fine. The only reason that they had him there was to showcase. So Tony has a line that's important earlier in the movie where he says, I got two things, my word and my balls. And this, because obviously, you know, as the movie goes on, you find out he doesn't tell the truth a lot. But ultimately, what this scene shows is he doesn't have balls either, because he ends up getting killed specifically because he couldn't go through with killing this person because he has his wife and kids in the car. I think that's why they had him there. That's the only explanation I can come up with.
Well, it is kind of interesting. Yes, I think you're right. It is kind of interesting because he's like, even when I'm lying, I give you my word or something like that. But it is kind of interesting that they kind of set him up. They don't know what they want to do with this guy. They kind of want him to be an anti-hero, right? Where they're like, here's this guy. Here's this rags to riches story, this immigrant. He makes all the right decisions. He's not a pussy. But then he's got a code when they're like, hey, you got to kill this guy. And then the guy's wife and kids get in the car. And I mean, they're really setting it. They're playing patty cake in the backseat. I know it was the 80s and seatbelts weren't a big deal. And maybe a mid 60s Citroen didn't have 3-point harnesses in the backseat, but they're playing patty cake. And they're really pandering to you about how horrible it is that they're going to kill these kids. And Tony's doing blow. He's got a bindle in the car. He's sniffing. He's driving for some reason. Again, this is a henchman's job. This is not a boss's job.
Budweiser cans all over the dash. You're a cop magnet. What the fuck are you doing?
Yes, you're going to get pulled over. You're drinking in the car. Tony Soprano doesn't go out. He sends Christopher to go do this kind of stuff. And he sends Paulie.
Yeah, this is 1983 New York. You could pay anybody anything to murder on the streets. It was mayhem back then.
Yeah, make it look like a robbery. That's back when people were getting mugged and stabbed all the time. That's a really good point, Ed. You blow up the car, immediately they're going to know it was Sosa. Who do I blame here? Oliver Stone. This is bad writing. They're going to know that it's the drug dealers back in Bolivia who he's named on 60 Minutes already. Like, it's a bad plan. Tony has a little bit of heart. And we think, this guy's actually a good guy. He shoots Hector Salamanca in the head. We're not going to talk about how the fact that everyone else in the car would have no eardrums for the next five years of their lives.
Shit.
But hey, that's how they do it in movies. But Sosa's not happy. And Tony is spiraling. And just when you think Tony might be the hero of this movie, he goes over to Manolo's house and murders him. Manolo deserved better. Do you guys not agree?
CBLS. Hey fam, there's still a lot more of this episode to hear, but it's only available to our bonus content subscribers. Click the link in the show notes or go to theballerlifestyle.com and subscribe so you never miss a minute of the show.
Reviewing some movies and shows and others. Top podcast, man, no one is above us. 5-star, even the haters will love us. And we're not trying to talk politics a lot. We'd much rather talk about dicks a lot. Shit's so hot, man, you know the shit's on top. Top podcast, man, it really hit the spot. Listen up.